Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I'm Rebecca Buckman of the Wall Street Journal. Tonight, we take a closer look at the business of venture capital in the first part of our series, To VC or Not to VC. It's an increasingly important question, I think, in Silicon Valley, as the climate for early-stage funding for startups has changed over the last few years. For one thing, many entrepreneurs just don't need as much venture capital funding as they used to. The dramatically lower costs of computer hardware, software, internet bandwidth, storage, and even human labor means many savvy CEOs can now get new web companies off the ground for a fraction of what they would have spent in the 1990s. There's also the experience factor. Today in Silicon Valley, we have a lot of very mature, seasoned entrepreneurs who built companies during the first internet boom, including some of our panelists here tonight. They may have, in some cases, plenty of cash to bootstrap their own companies these days, meaning they may be able to turn down even an attractive offer from a venture capitalist. At the same time, venture capitalists who take stakes in small startups with the hope of a big payout later have more money to invest today than ever before. The industry is managing about $260 billion in capital, the most ever, and the average venture fund size is higher today than it was during the boom of the late 90s. VCs are also now competing with buyout firms and even giant hedge funds who are willing to do the occasional startup deal. Still, VCs do certainly have a lot to offer, and they can supply more than just cold, hard cash. With the market more competitive, many of them are now becoming more hands-on managers. They're helping their companies with business strategy, hiring, and even international expansion. And of course, their capital is still sorely needed when it comes to building large, capital-intensive businesses like semiconductor factories or consumer gadgets. Tonight, we've assembled an impressive panel of experts to talk about this. Greg Goldfarb is a vice president with Summit Partners. He joined the Palo Alto office of Summit Partners in 2002 and focuses on growth equity investments and recapitalizations in bootstrapped, profitable growth companies. David Samuel is chairman of Brondell, Inc., which I'm sure you'll be interested to know makes a high-tech toilet seat for the U.S. market, not your typical Silicon Valley company. A serial entrepreneur, Dave founded Brondell in 2003 with Scott Pinizzato, and he also currently serves as the president of Grouper Networks. Nick Sturiali is a general partner with Seven Rosen Funds. Nick's six-year tenure at Seven Rosen was preceded by 14 years of experience at several startups, including Candescent, a display company, and Timber Technologies, which came out of the University of California at Berkeley, and which Seven Rosen later incubated. His current investment focus is in enterprise-focused technologies, including chips, software, systems, and services. Michael Baum is CEO of Splunk, an innovator in log and IT data search, specializing in IT infrastructure. In addition to Splunk, Michael is a co-founder of Collation, Arthas, and Reality Online. He was a software engineer at IBM's Silicon Valley Laboratory and a member of the original IBM PC development team. Finally, Scott Potter, at the end, is the founding managing partner of San Francisco Equity Partners. In his career as a private equity investor, CEO, and advisor, Scott has been involved in over 75 private equity financings, 20 public offerings, and 15 M&A deals. So please welcome our panel. So I just wanted to start, before we kick off with formal questions, trying to get an idea of who's here tonight in the audience. I'm guessing we have some entrepreneurs who may be looking for venture capital funding, or maybe they're, you know, thinking about bootstrapping companies themselves. How many entrepreneurs do we have here? Okay, quite a few. How many of you are looking for money? Okay. How many of you just want to flip yourselves to Yahoo or Google for $30 million? Oh, you okay, very good. It's worked for many companies. Well, I wanted to start off with Nick, since he's the VC on the panel, with probably the most traditional early stage focus, as we sometimes think of venture capital. So, Nick, given all these new trends today, you know, lower costs, things like that, why do entrepreneurs need you? Tell us, why should you still have a job?
Well, gee, thanks for that softball. Why should I still have a job? Well, because there are entrepreneurs that need money. I think that, you know, going to a VC and raising money is a big decision. It's very expensive to raise money from venture capitalists. I spent, you know, roughly 13 years being an entrepreneur like people out here did before I decided to join the dark side. And so I think I can see both sides of the equation. There is an awful lot to argue to not go to a VC. Many companies have successfully navigated the rocky shoals of starting and developing a company without ever taking a nickel of venture capital money. And so there are many, many existence proofs of doing it without going to Sand Hill and taking money from the likes of people on up here. But I do think now spending 6 years at Seven Rosen, there is an awful lot of reasons why getting venture capital money can be quite useful in doing so. And I'll just go through a couple of reasons why. One, most entrepreneurs look to VCs for the sort of what I call the cosmetic things, which is introductions and access and credibility. And they want introductions to customers, strategic partners, a talent pool, vendor relationships. They want that credibility. They want introductions to other venture capitalists. They think that that will help them in their life cycle of developing the company through its Series A, its Series B, from development stage to revenue and on into profitability and hopefully into a public offering. And all those things are true and those are important. But I would tell you that I think the more subtle things are often more important in the relationship between a VC and the founding team. And I put those things in what I would call decision-making foresight. I think what a VC has, especially a VC who's been in the business for a while, is an awful lot of scar tissue of watching mistakes get made between a decision that gets made and the outcome. And so what I get to see is a lot of patterns of when a decision gets made about a budget decision or a person that gets hired or a strategy that gets implemented and what the outcome is. And so I begin to see correlation, if not causality. And so that pattern happens over and over and over again, and often the movie that I go to turns out bad. And so that, you know, often I'm involved in the movie, too. It's not just me standing in the third row of the bleachers eating popcorn. I'm often involved in it. And so, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, when it doesn't turn out well, I get a volume of experience that accumulates. And so what you're buying with expensive venture capital dollars is an awful lot of compressed experience about developing an early stage company. And so what you're hoping to get with an investor relationship is getting that experience and insight ahead of time so you as an entrepreneur can get that brought into a company so often you can be saved from yourself because you are going to make mistakes. Every startup does. I was in three startups. My gosh, we made every mistake imaginable. And believe me, the permutations of mistakes that can be made are awesome. And so what you're trying to do is minimize the number of mistakes you can make because there's a lot of competition out there for customers' dollars. And what you're trying to do is take the scarce number of dollars you have and make the least amount of mistakes possible. And so having a VC that is like-minded with your values and is impassioned with what you're doing and can bring that scar tissue and foresight with you can be an awfully big asset. And I'm sure as the panel goes on, we can get into what that manifests itself to look like.
Well, maybe I was going to ask Michael to kind of follow up on that because Michael's company, Splunk, has actually taken some venture funding from Nick's firm, from Seven Rosen. Michael, can you talk a little bit about, you know, whether some of these things that Nick mentioned worked out for you? I mean, was that one reason why you decided to raise traditional venture capital?
He's probably going to refute everything I just said, by the way.
Actually, the reason I decided to raise money this time is because my wife told me to stop writing checks for the company. So. Well, this is venture startup number six for me. I've been doing this since I was 21 years old. And I think what Nick says is true, is that there is a lot of compressed experience. The question in my mind is it's like any other relationship you get into, you know, getting married, hiring an attorney, hiring an employee. Do you understand the delivery device for that experience, right? Because that will vary dramatically across you know, the different kinds of
VC. Is that what you asked your wife?
Well, you know, taking VC money is kind of like taking drugs, right? Be careful what you get hooked on and what kind of delivery device you get, right? But there's dramatic differences in the venture capitalists that are out there that you can get involved with. I mean, there's a lot of money out there. If you got a decent idea, you're solving a decent customer problem, and you have a good team of people together, you can raise money for just about anything. The question is, are you raising money from somebody that's going to be a good partner for you that you can work with, that can deliver that experience in a way that you and your team can consume the experience and apply it to your business? So I'd say in my experience of doing this for 20 years, raising money from VCs, starting companies, that it's a mixed bag. You know, some people are good at it, some people are not good at it. Often the guys that are really good at it are the ones, or gals, are the ones that know how to take their hands off the wheel and sit in the back seat for a while and let people make a couple of mistakes before they chime in. I find that the guys that have their hands on the wheel the whole time are probably the least useful to me as a CEO running a company, because you want the person or the people running the company to own the outcome, not the person investing in the company to own the outcome.
Right. How has the environment maybe changed? Maybe there's two or three points you could make about, you know, how dealing with VCs may be different today than it was when you started your first company, which was about 20 years ago, right?
Well, I'd say 20 years ago, back in the mid-80s, 84, 85, when that was, it was a lot harder to raise money. I mean, the venture capital industry was a cottage industry. I think in 1985, when I raised my first venture money, there was less than $1 billion raised in the whole early stage venture capital industry. Most everybody in the venture industry and entrepreneurs starting early stage tech companies knew each other. It's a big business now. You know, it's an institutionalized business, the venture capital businesses today. And as a result, you've got a lot of people that are chasing ideas with money that don't necessarily have a lot of experience in starting companies. Part of the reason we went to work with Nick and Seven Rosen, and this is the first time I've worked with Seven Rosen or Nick, is that we saw people that had that experience, that knew how to apply that experience. They had started companies before. And I'll tell you, when you're in the midst of problems with your company, which you are all the time, even if things are going well, you want somebody who understands what it's like to be in your position.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Scott mentioned that issue to me before. There is an issue today with some venture capitalists maybe not having the amount of operational experience that they've had before. We have more guys that maybe just went from business school to banking to venture capital. I mean, is this true, and is this a problem,
yeah,
do you think?
I think the industry has become very institutionalized, and I think it's harder for venture firms to differentiate themselves. I think there's pools of value that are added. By definition, capital is one of them. Most venture firms have the money to make the investment. That's not really something you can differentiate. Even some of the infrastructure services we talk about, access to the top law firms, access to recruiters, how do you set up an employee incentive plan, all of these things that need to go into starting a company, most competent venture firms can do that, and it's very hard to differentiate yourself based on that. And I know when I was running my venture-backed company, to me, the most important thing, which Michael commented on, was having somebody that had sat in my seat before as a CEO. Using a sports analogy, I think it's a lot easier to be a great coach if you've taken the snap from center before and you know what that's like. And being a startup CEO can be a very lonely, hard job. And there's brutal decisions that you have to make, especially when you go through things like times you went through in 2000, 2001. And having that person that's been there, done that, to be a sounding board and help you make those decisions is absolutely critical. So I think it's becoming less about the firm, because these firms are becoming very institutionalized, and it's about the partner that you're going to be working with every day. And is that somebody you want to go to battle with? And that's really what it comes down to. And just to further that point, I think there's a lot of folks that have now gone from Ivy League education, MBA, maybe a year or two at McKinsey, and then they go into a venture firm. That's not necessarily the guy I want mentoring me through this process. I think venture-backed CEO, being a venture-backed CEO is a business of mentorship, and I want my mentor to have done it before. And I think there's a lack of that.
Rebecca, I just wanted to comment on one other thing. I was thinking about the difference between now and 20 years ago is, you think about the current environment where there's a lot of venture money out there being invested in a lot of early stage companies, and there's not necessarily a very robust public market today for venture-backed companies.
For IPOs.
Yeah, for IPOs, right. The acquisition market is picking up a bit, in most of the segments of technology. But you get people sitting on your board that even though they might have the experience today, they're on 7, 8, 9, 10 other boards. I've seen people on 12 or 13 boards. Mm-hmm. And even if they are great, how much of their time can you really get when you need something that's important and you make the call to them? And I think that's something else to consider, is to look for people and firms that have a policy of limiting the number of boards that their partners sit on.
Mm-hmm. No, that's definitely true. Well, I wanted to turn to David, because David's taken a slightly different route with your latest company, Brondell. You end up raising money from just one big angel investor, a pretty well-known guy, Mark Cuban, who we see on the basketball court sometimes, I guess. I mean, were some of those issues that Michael was talking about relevant to your decision not to take VC funding this time, or did it have to do more with the experience that you had at your previous startups?
I think that I do have one. I have a Web 1.0 success underneath my belt, so that's given me a little bit of a bankroll to experience things, and I guess my advice to the entrepreneur overall is, if you have the ability to bootstrap, build a prototype, get the company moving forward before presenting to VCs, I think that's the best case. As for my experience with Brondell, there aren't many VCs investing in toilet seats. Maybe a lot of them are putting money in the toilet, but not necessarily in toilet seats. And honestly,
it's an oldie but a goodie.
Yeah. So if you actually look at the Rolodex of people for me to approach, there's actually not many that have experience, even within the consumer goods space. And I'll just tell you the story about Mark Cuban and how he became an investor and shed a little bit of light on it. I basically ran into Mark at Web 2.0. I knew him from the Web 1.0 days. Web 2.0 is an internet conference. And I mentioned to him about Brondell and told him a few of the great things about what we're doing, 220 million residential toilet seats in America, 8 million toilet seats sold every year, and we just need to make it a better market. And his pitch to me was, he understood the pitch, but he said, I will match your investment. And so basically the reason why he was able to say yes and come on so easily is basically, you know, put your money where your mouth is. And so so honestly, our Series A was actually a match of my funds and Mark Cuban's funds. And so that that made it obviously much easier to raise money. And so I think that if you have the ability to invest, it does give you a little bit more leverage in the situation. I do believe when you go to these internet conferences today, there is a lot of money that people are trying to put to work. I mean, I am just amazed at when you go to Web 2.0 or there's IMDb or I don't know. There's all these internet conferences down in the valley. I don't even know them all. And if you ask people, entrepreneurs versus VCs in the audience, I swear these days it's almost like 75% VCs. And so it's a great pro-entrepreneur environment. And I do believe that if you have a good idea, you can go out there and raise money. But the recommendation would be is if you can just kind of bootstrap it a little bit, get the thing to a prototype, build a simple version of it, I think you're going to have a much easier time of holding on to more of your company, which is really an important piece of the equation.
But have you run up against some of these problems that were brought up earlier, VCs being overstretched, you know, maybe sitting on too many boards, not being able to offer you the help that you need? Or
I think so, and that comes down to what Scott was mentioning, how really the personal relationship that you have with the VC is very important. And luckily, there are so many of them that are trying to put money to work. You're hopefully be in a position where maybe you can choose between a few of them. But I do think that personal relationship is important in making sure that they have time on their schedule to be able to help you out.
Right. Well, I think another trend we brought up early on, but one I wanted to ask Greg about, has to do with how much money it takes to start, you know, a Silicon Valley company today. Obviously, there's lots of different business models, but if we're talking about internet stuff, Web 2.0, you know, you want to start the next Facebook or something, it really doesn't cost as much money as it used to at all. Is this what you're seeing? And does this make the life of a VC a little bit harder because maybe people just don't need as much money as they used to?
Yeah, I think in two sectors in particular, cost structures have changed a lot and really changed the calculation as to whether you bootstrap. And those two sectors are anything that's consumer internet focused, and particularly also in software, not in big million-dollar enterprise software, but in ASP-type software models, software as service, where you can rapidly deliver prototypes to your customers, figure out if they like it by their usage, and then decide, you know, what you do next. And I think in those two sectors, the real things that have changed are, first, internet technologies have made the cost of developing a website or developing software much, much lower. Doesn't mean you're going to win, but to get to first prototype or to get to first product, it's a lot faster, it's a lot cheaper than it used to be. Work also, secondly, is virtualized in many cases now. You can find the right talent in the right place. We at Summit only work with companies that have bootstrapped themselves, and so essentially, we're on the other side of the entrepreneurial mountain, and these folks are choosing us. And so we have the opportunity to go out and see a lot of these bootstrap companies. And I'm amazed at where people are finding talent. Vietnam, Bulgaria, Romania, Russia, everywhere you can go, you find these places. You're never going to see drug discovery companies who are building the next, you know, famous molecule to cure cancer bootstrap. It's never going to happen. But in software, in consumer internet, it's a lot easier to figure out if you have a workable business concept before you raise capital. And I really encourage entrepreneurs to do that. There's no sense in raising capital if you can't get some basic feedback, some basic data on your idea first. And you can do that in those two sectors in particular.
Is the quality of this outsourced work, I mean, you talk about Bulgaria and Vietnam, not just, you know, China and India, which we normally think of for outsourced software development. Is this stuff up to snuff? I mean, you see this code and you say this is pretty good?
It is literally all over the map. Some of it is amazing. And you just wouldn't believe what 20 people in St. Petersburg making $800 a month can do. It's just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I think the people who do that successfully have some sort of existing connection. I think it is a lot riskier for people to try to form those connections at the outset of the business and take the shot. I have some friends who've tried to do that and have had very, very bad experiences. Mm-hmm. So the people I've seen succeed at it tend to have some sort of social connection or even, you know, deeper connection to that community programming. They're getting talent.
There tends to be a very big, though, drop-off with engineering product management when you leave the Valley, when you go to Eastern Europe, when you go to India. You know, you have to be very careful that the institutional memory of developing a product and bringing it to market doesn't drop off, and you've got a bunch of entry-level Java programmers that are building code for the first time and left a university, and so this is their first time building a commercial product, and they have no concept of what it takes to build commercial code.
Well, but it's not even entry level programmers, though. And I think I'm sitting up here listening to these comments and thinking, you know, this is the systemic problem with the venture capital industry in general. Is VCs are out chasing, you know, the next consumer hit on the web and getting away from where they really made a lot of money in the early days, and that is things with some kind of an intellectual property content that is actually defensible in the market. And if you look at projects like that, I mean, the kind of thing that we do at Splunk, and we've got a search engine for log files in the data center, right? We go in and we crawl the data center. We index all this crazy stuff coming out of all types of different machines and network devices. And it's pretty heady stuff. Well, we went over to Odessa in the Ukraine. We had a social relationship there with a friend of mine that I've worked with for 15 years who runs a company. He's got 60 engineers in the Ukraine. And I'll tell you, these guys in Odessa that write C++ code are some of the most sophisticated engineers on the planet. Well, we tried for 6 months to outsource part of our, you know, lowest level of product development with these guys. We had a project manager here on the ground that spoke Russian, spoke Ukraine, flew back and forth, and it was a disaster. When you're trying to innovate something very quickly that has a high intellectual property content, doing it, you know, 3,000, 5,000, 10,000 miles away doesn't work. These guys couldn't keep up with the pace of creativity and innovation that we had going on in our office on a 7x24 basis. So I think this notion that you can farm things out might work for low intellectual property content projects, but certainly not for something that has any technological, you know, defensibility to it.
I would also just be concerned about the acquisition target nature of it. Just you hear Google you know, wants to acquire engineers. And actually, I'm not that familiar with, you know, acquisitions that have occurred with when 80% of your tech team is in a different country. So I don't actually know the answer to that. Does that happen?
A lot, all the time. I think, you know, our philosophy and the advice we would give to entrepreneurs in general is architect your business to be a great business, to be inherently profitable, to have a low-cost structure, and to, you know, show revenue growth. And do things well with high quality, and exits take care of themselves. If it's not Google, you're going to have a heck of a profitable, nice business that someone will come along and buy at some point. And worst case scenario is it throws off cash flow that you can reap as dividends. So, you know, I think that should be the calculation of, you know, will Google acquire us for our engineers ought to be a very low ranking on the priority list, and much more on the priority list should be, you know, are customers buying? Do they like it? Can we build a profitable business off of this? And if we can, then do I think about accelerating my growth rate by raising capital in order to get bigger faster or to acquire enough scale or just enhance the overall qualitative factors of my business so that, you know, when somebody approaches me, I look like a terrific opportunity for them to acquire.
So I actually think that's a very interesting point, and also being more of a later stage, my fund focuses on later stage opportunities. People are pointing to things like Flickr and Delicious, recent Yahoo acquisitions where folks were able to bootstrap and not take any venture money and sell the company for $20 or $30 million. I think it's important to keep in mind that what those teams built, and they're great teams, and I know them, were great function, great features and great product features of a broader offering. Those folks did not build a profitable business. If they decided to take it to the next level, it still remains to be seen whether a social community posting site for photos can be a profitable business that Greg is referring to. And if it could, it would have required a lot of investment. They would have had to build a media sales force. They would have had to do a lot of the things that venture capital would have required. So I think it's dangerous when you take these one or two points off the curve and point to them as success stories when they really might be more of a function of some sort of buzz factor or function of Yahoo with an overinflated stock price that's out there buying stuff because it's easier for them to buy or build it. I, as an entrepreneur, would not want to build a business on the thesis that Yahoo is going to buy a product feature for a crazy amount of money. That's a very scary proposition as an entrepreneur. And I think some of those acquisitions are leading people to make those decisions.
Well, and Scott, as you mentioned, as sort of a later stage VC, and I think Greg, you're in the same boat as far as focusing on slightly more mature companies, maybe you both could speak to this issue. Is there kind of a squeeze going on the top end as well? I mean, as all these other dynamics are going on, you also face more competition for getting these deals because you've got these big players, these buyout shops and even hedge funds. That they've got, you know, a lot more capital to put to work even than the VC community. I mean, are you encountering these guys? And do you think, gosh, now we need to step it up even more because these guys might be competing for these deals? Or
I would guess Greg probably sees mm-hmm. that more than I do in terms mm-hmm. of agent and deals. The whole hedge fund coming into the venture community, no disrespect, I think is a bit of a fantasy of the media. I have never seen that in any of our late deals that we've looked at. And in fact, we look at certain transactions with hedge funds we have a relationship with, and they are very upfront to say, we will add no value other than money. And one of the reasons they like to partner with guys like us, smaller, later stage funds, is that we will roll up our sleeves and do the work. So I think when we go back to that original salvo that we all made, which is we have to differentiate ourselves based on the strength of our operating history, connection with entrepreneurs and CEOs, not the color of our money, I think hedge funds very, very quickly fall out of that analysis on any for any entrepreneur. So I haven't seen that. I don't know if you guys
know. You do hear stories, though, about hedge funds setting up venture shops.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and you do hear, you know, it's there are some venture firms who I won't name here that are, you know, literally have become money management shops, and they're expanding. They were in the Series A business, and they are now expanding. They're expanding into buyout. They're doing pipes. They have become massive, you know, the Walmart to the venture business. And so it's there's an amazing expansion going on in the venture business, and it continues unabated.
And I'll make two related comments that, you know, one in regard to the hedge funds, all these new pools of capital out there. I think as an entrepreneur, the most important question you want to ask of yourself in thinking about a potential partner investor in the company is, what are their incentives? What are they driven by? And how is this person going to behave because of those incentives? Hedge funds are set up in a very, very different way than a private equity firm. Short-term focus, they get paid every year. The incentive structure is entirely different than the right venture capital or private equity firm that sets up its incentives to be very, very long-lived. You know, for, I'll give you an example. So we might make each individual at Summit might make two investments a year. So over the course of 3 years, we'll make six investments. Boy, our livelihoods, our economics, and our career successes are completely wedded to the success of those six companies. And if one of them doesn't do well, that's a black mark on our track record. And so I think that's a really important thing that you've got to dig into when you're an entrepreneur, is think about the incentive structure of the person you're about to partner with. In regard to the larger question of, you know, the amount of capital and the pools of capital that are out there today, clearly it's, I mean, the world has a tremendous amount of capital. And I think I would point to the thing you should think about when you're considering what source of capital to take as an entrepreneur is, think about the business model of the person that you're thinking about partnering with. Because the question is, are they going to be aligned with you the whole way along the way? Everybody's got different approaches to the business, and are they a fit for me is really the key question. If you're trying to build, you know, the next enormous, again, to use a drug discovery company, or the next software business, or you're trying to go from bootstrapping into, you know, public caliber company, your choices of who the right partner is ought to be very different. You should not look at the same venture firm if you're in those three different buckets. And so, you know, there's the right capital for you is out there. You just have to find the right capital. I mean, that's the most important thing to think about.
So I was going to qualify something I said earlier about there's a lot of money out there. There is a lot of money out there, but you can waste a lot of time finding it. So I was out of the market of raising venture money for about, 5 years, because I started a company. We were in it for 3 or 4 years. It got sold to Yahoo. I was at Yahoo for a year and a half. And then I had to come back into the venture market for raising money with this company. And the venture industry had changed a lot. A lot of guys I knew, they retired. They made so much money. They're gone. One guy races cars for a living. The other guy's an author up in Alaska somewhere. And so I had to meet a whole new crop of venture people to raise money. And you'd go out and you'd have a coffee with somebody, or you'd have a phone call with them and say, so you're doing Series A deals, right? Like early stage, we have no customers, we have a prototype. Oh, yeah, we do those all the time, right? And I can tell you 9 out of 10 of these guys I'd go meet with, the first question out of their mouth would be, okay, so we need to talk to a dozen of your paying customers. And I'm like, I don't have a dozen paying customers. I have, you know, a prototype, which is about 6 months away from shipping as a product. And I have a bunch of people that tell me they'll pay for it if I ship it. But so I would encourage you, before you engage in going out to find money, is to find out who's really investing in the kind of stage and type of business that you have. And it's easy to go look up people's track records and see what they've done. And that's, you know, like they say in the mutual fund business, you know, past performance is actually a pretty good indicator in this case of future, you know, activity and performance.
Well, just to kind of follow up on that, you guys have talked about, you know, if you're going to raise capital, know who you should be raising the capital from. But what about if you're a step before that? Maybe you think, well, I think I could build this for, you know, under $100,000. Maybe I just need to ask my rich relative or my, you know, friend I know who might qualify as an angel investor to chip in. I mean, are there some rules maybe or guidelines that you guys could articulate for, you know, when is it best to stick with that and when is it best to go out and say, okay, I think I really do need professional venture funding?
Yeah, I have a few that I'll, and I'm sure everybody will add to this, but I think there are a few questions I'll just ask really quickly. So is the idea bootstrappable, right? First question. Second is, are you patient? Because I think the biggest difference I would describe between an entrepreneur who bootstraps and one who doesn't is some people are patient, some people aren't. Some people want to go big very quickly, and some people are incrementalists. And you have to self-profile and figure out which one you are. If you can be patient and be an incrementalist, I would suggest, you know, that bootstrapping is an option. If not, if you're a go-big person, don't bootstrap, because you will not be happy and you'll end up flaming out as a business. And then the third one I'd point to, which would be generally a relevant one, is, do you have a specialized piece of knowledge? Do you have special experience with a problem? you're much more likely to be successful bootstrapping if you've lived and breathed the problem as, say, you know, a telecom engineer who now wants to go build a network engineering system than if you're an MBA who has come up with, you know, the next big enterprise software idea, though you're not a software person yourself. I think those are three questions that, I'd suggest everybody ask before you make the decision on whether to bootstrap or not.
I also find that probably writing the traditional business plan is not necessary anymore. I don't know if you guys are seeing that, but it's really just the PowerPoint presentation. If you can get your idea down into a PowerPoint presentation, I definitely would vet it with the contacts that you have. And if you have a list of VCs, you know, kind of prioritize them, and the people at the top that you really want to get, don't start with those meetings because you really want to start with people further down the list, because by the time you get that meeting with Moritz at Sequoia Capital, you really want to be on your A game, and you've met with numerous other people who have said, you got this problem with the plan, you got this problem with the plan, I don't like this, etc. So if you are going to go do that pitch, and it is a time-consuming thing, so that's the other piece that I definitely side with Michael on, and the way to kind of work on that time-consuming and have answers around that is really to have a team together. And so it's not all-encompassing by the whole company. So you could have, if I was working with Michael, like Michael would be the guy to go raise the money, and I would be maybe the guy to build the product. So it's really the team that you can put together, and it's not like I need to necessarily be in all of the VC meetings. You just have one person on your team focusing on it, because it takes a lot of time to raise money.
I guess just a couple comments. One, the business plan is not for the VC. It's for you. Okay, it's an intellectual exercise for you to write down. It is to force you to go through all the elements of putting a business together. So it's not an exercise to hand over to say, here, I've checked all the boxes. So if it's on pieces of napkin, that's okay. If that's what you need to think through putting a business together. The second point is, I agree with Greg that, you know, what we're looking for is people that have a specialized expertise, a very, very unique understanding of a particular domain area, and even a very odd view of a common problem. You know, maybe a problem that's been around for a long time, and someone just comes and they have a very, very bizarre way of looking at it that is we haven't seen before. That's interesting to
like
us.
Like the toilet seat.
Cold toilet seats.
Like a cold toilet seat, yeah. You know, and it, you know.
Make it warm. Very hot.
And then I think, so those kind of, and by the way, Seven Rosen does seed projects all the time. So we've in our latest fund, we've did 14 projects that we funded $500,000 or less. So we will put small money into one or two people that are what I would call three engineers, a dog, and a dream. And so, you know, there does have to be enough to, you know, of people that can go work on a product. But it doesn't have to be a complete team. And then finally, you know, entrepreneurship to me is practically, if not completely, a spiritual calling. When someone comes to me and says, I'm looking at something and I want to go do something, I don't look at whether or not they've say the right buzzwords or they've got the Web 2.0 language well-crafted or they've done the PowerPoint. I look at what they've done. I look at their behavior. I see what is the activity you've done to prove to yourself that you've got this idea thought out. If you've paid your Visa card off with your MasterCard to exhaust all these meetings, that's evidence that you're an entrepreneur. You know, if you've been told no 35 times and you're still having this meeting with me, that's evidence you're an entrepreneur. You know, entrepreneurs are believers. They are optimists. They take no, they shrug it off, and they keep going. If they really want to do this, they absolutely put up with an enormous amount of people that say this cannot be done. That is what defines an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurship is not about making a quick killing. It is not about saying, holy cow, web advertising is a hot space. I think I can raise money off of these poor saps in the venture capital community. Because I'm sorry, there are a lot of mercenary entrepreneurs out there that find that Web 2.0 is not actually an internet definition, it is a venture capital fundraising definition. And so that is the difference. So what we look for is entrepreneurship, people that really want to do something. When Michael came through, you know, Michael is a purebred entrepreneur. I mean, he has to do this. He is functionally incapable of doing anything else. He's useless, except for starting companies. I mean, he's not good at sports or singing or. I mean, this is what he does. I mean, and if you talk to his wife, I mean, he gets up in the morning and thinks about building a company. And he has signature marks all over himself for doing this, and that's what we look for.
The one thing I'll add to that, just to throw a little bit of cold water on it, is in this analysis of whether to take money or not, be real with yourself on the financial part of your business and the projections. Every funding presentation has zero revenue, $200,000, $22 million. None of us believe that. I don't think any of us have had businesses that have really done that. So sometimes you get caught up in putting these projections together that you think the financial community wants to see. But you really need to be real with yourself on what this business can deliver, what are the capital requirements, and if it's $2 million instead of $200,000, and that really is reality when you take your rose-colored glasses off, you might make a different decision. So I'd be very real with yourselves in terms of what the cash requirements are to get to wherever you want to get to with your business.
Let me give you the real scoop, though. Forget about what these guys say. Don't bootstrap your company. Go raise venture money and go raise it early, because VCs like to buy futures. They don't like to buy reality. And they'll pay more for futures than they will for reality. So put together the plan that says you're going to do the hockey stick, because if you don't, they're not going to fund you.
You're talking to the
wrong VCs. Be very passionate about your project, but you're better off coming to them with the seed of an idea, thought out on the business end, thought out, you know, on kind of how you're going to differentiate this in the market, have talked to a couple of customers, than if you have a half-baked product and you give them a lousy demo.
Okay, well, when you throw something out like that out there, we got to respond.
So let me give you the real, real reality. So he gives you the realistic plan. Then I tell him he's got to goose it up or my partners won't fund the deal. So he gooses it up and my partners say, well, that forecast is ridiculous. And I say, yeah, I know, but it's goosed up from his conservative plan. And so we forecast it somewhere in the middle. And he says, okay, that's probably somewhere in between something we don't believe in. So that's acceptable.
But I want to also make a comment to the first thing you said, which is, you know, you don't have to raise capital. You know, this is a really key life decision you're about to make. You're going to spend an enormous amount of your energy, your resources, your opportunity costs, and you should plan on it being for 5 to 7 years if you have any desire to be successful. And to do that, I think you ought to feel pretty good that you got a chance of keeping a large piece of that company at the end of it. We love when a company goes public or it's acquired in our portfolio, if the entrepreneur owns a majority of the company at that time, then we are certain we did really well in that deal. And so I think you ought to weigh that calculation, because raising VC is not a fait accompli. It works in the right situation, and it's very good in the right situation. It should be an option at the table. It should not be a default option. You should think very hard about the investment of your time and energy you're going to take, and whether it's a beneficial thing to do to take in that capital. It's a cost-benefit analysis as an entrepreneur that you make, and only you can make it.
But, isn't it difficult, though, for some entrepreneurs to heed that message today? Because, you know, as Dave said, you can get funded on a PowerPoint presentation, and I don't know if this is necessarily a good thing, but, you know, cash is so plentiful. I have heard some entrepreneurs tell me, look, the valuation you can get, you know, financially, you could come out with such a good deal, you might as well do it. I mean, is it difficult for people to say no in a way?
Yeah, it is, but let's play that out. So you're the entrepreneur. Let's play it out. Let's role play that for a second. So you raise $5 million at a $5 million pre-money. You sell 50% of your company.
What does that mean? You sell
50% of your company and you take in five. And let's say things don't go great, right? You got to raise another round of capital. And things didn't go great because you tried to go way too fast, way ahead of what the market wanted you to do. And now you need to raise a round of capital too. You need to raise another $3 to $4 million of capital, except now you can only raise it at a $4 million pre-money. So now you're going to be a minority position in your company. And let's say you finally figure out the idea and it's starting to work. And this thing is going to be a phenomenal success. And it's going to be a business that's going to make $10 million in revenue in 3 years. And you could sell it maybe for $30 million. Well, you could have figured out at the very beginning whether the idea was going to work or not before you raised that $5 million and ended up being a minority investor in a company that's going to ultimately be acquired for $30 million. So I think the fact that there's a lot of capital out there should not influence your decision. What should influence your decision is what the business needs and whether there is an economic benefit to raising the capital, both in terms of the dollars themselves, but in terms of the partner you're going to get.
I think you're forgetting an essential element, Greg, though. The thing that makes every one of these businesses succeed is not the original idea. It's the people that you get involved with the company. And you cannot go out as an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley today or in Trenton, New Jersey. I'm from New Jersey. I resemble that remark. And hire A-player people into your company without capital. They will not come work for you. I have two founders in my business. It's only the three of us that were crazy enough, you know, to go for 2.5 years on this thing on a shoestring, pouring all of our money into it. There's no way we're going to hire top-notch engineers, top-notch marketing talent, A-player product managers into a company without capital. There's tremendous competition for
Michael,
A-player people.
You're making there are two embedded assumptions in what you just said. First, it's the high intellectual property, classic kind of we're going to build a rocket ship sort of business plan. So we're going to build something that is going to be fully baked in sort of a, you know, astrophysics kind of way before we take it to market. And then the second thing I think you're assuming is the necessity of speed and quickness, because a lot of what you said in terms of we got to get the A talent in marketing, we got to get the A talent in engineering, presupposes a need for speed. And I would just tell you that all we do is look for these companies, and they're in Bozeman, Montana, where Right Now is, they're in Kansas City, they're in Bend, Oregon, they're not always in Silicon Valley, and you don't necessarily have to build your company in Silicon Valley. And I know plenty of bootstrap companies in Silicon Valley that are building high intellectual property companies very, very effectively. But these companies tend to start with a couple of people. They build a prototype. They show it to customers. They say, what do you think? I'm doing this in my garage with my buddy who's a programmer. What do you think of the idea? And if I build this, will you buy it the next time I come back? And then they come back 30 days later and say, okay, here it is now. It's version one, but will you buy it for $50,000? And they make their first sale, and then they go out and they do it another six times. That is a perfectly legitimate way to build a company, and we've backed about 285 companies that have done exactly that. So I think you don't have to necessarily go fast, and you don't necessarily have to get the full marketing team, the full business team, before you have an idea of whether the business works.
You know, I'm not talking about the full team or going fast, but to Nick's point earlier, your ability to learn quickly as an entrepreneur and as an entrepreneurial team is key to getting the risk out of your business, out of your business plan. And you can't fit a lot of quick cycles of learning on your product, with your customer, with your market, into a week, a month, a year, unless you have very good people to do that. It's just impossible.
Well, I mean, following up on that, we seem to be drawing kind of a distinction between a Web 2.0 business and a much more in-depth kind of business that requires more capital. Maybe for people in the audience that are not total tech heads, maybe we can talk a little bit about Web 2.0, what it is. Is it still here? Is it over? And is this a good thing or a bad thing for entrepreneurs and venture
capital? That was actually one of the things I was going to just talk about, is how long is this Web 2.0 window open? My definition of Web 1.0 was really from 1998 to 2000. And obviously, many acquisitions and many, many IPOs happened in 1999 and 2000. And then there was the downtime. And there are very few entrepreneurs, that managed to go through the downtime and come out on the other side with a sale. Web 2.0, what would you say Web 2.0 started? I would say
2 years ago.
Is it really 2 years ago? I'd say a year and a half ago. My estimate would be about a year and a half ago. And one of the big questions that I think everybody wants to know, including the VCs and entrepreneurs, is how long does the window stay open for Web 2.0? And honestly, I believe that the window is open for another year. I believe that there is so much excitement and interest within the space that we will see another downturn again.
Are we talking about the window to get funded, or are we talking about the window to build a great profitable internet company? Because those are two very different things.
I believe that it's the window to get funded or the window to have an acquisition. As for being a profitable business, I do believe that it's going to become there's going to be a lot of fallout. There's so many players within the space. There's going to be, you know, a lot of these companies are merging. A bunch of them are going to go on the wayside. But I believe that the, you know, we're going to see another downturn. We're going to see the 2001 through 2004. I believe sometime very soon.
The difficult thing, though, is that the venture industry has raised $20 billion a year for the last 3 years, 93, 4, and 5. And so you've got a situation where the venture industry has got this enormous push to put money into the ground. And so there is this just huge pent-up supply of capital looking for projects. And so where there's supply, demand comes. And so entrepreneurs have popped up saying, me too. And so 40 projects, 50, 100 projects pop up that literally copy the latest Facebook, MySpace, online advertising thing that seems to get a lot of attention. And so it generates what appears to be a market where there wasn't one. And so it is the tail wagging the dog now. And so and this is not the media, but it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that there is the venture industry are literally defining consumer markets that don't necessarily exist yet.
Yeah, but I mean, the issue I have with that is what they're really defining is funding markets.
Yeah.
I don't think they're defining markets consumer products that can be sold at a price point that's above what it costs to make it and build a profitable business.
We're back to
our last two deals as a late stage fund are Web 1.0 companies that others gave up on. And they're now both greater than $20 million in revenue, profitable. Sand Hill Road wouldn't fund those businesses today.
Right.
So I think as entrepreneurs, you have to ask yourself, what is my goal? Is my goal to get funded? Or is my goal to build the business that's my dream? And yeah, I got to raise capital along the way. And I would really suggest that it's the latter, and that chasing what Sand Hill Road is funding today is not necessarily a guarantee of building a real business. Look at the social network companies. Have any of those guys actually made any money or had a great outcome? It doesn't seem like that.
Well, the entrepreneurs at MySpace did well. They obviously didn't have a full piece of it, but the MySpace guys did well. Yeah, Friendster's back at it. We'll see what happens with Friendster.
So 300 deals have been funded now following that.
So. Yes.
And they can't
And there's
money.
No IPO market. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a huge pent-up demand VCs, and so it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out.
There actually is an IPO market. There's an IPO market for mature later stage
Web 1.0 companies that managed to make it through.
Can we talk about that for a minute? What does it take to take a company public, you know, this year, next year? I mean, where does a company have to be in order to tap into the public market for funds?
You can look at, in the internet space right now, there are plenty of nicely trading on a multiple basis, 50 to 100 million revenue B2C media companies. Look at The Knot, look at Planet Out. These are businesses that are growing 20 or 30% a year. They're doing 50 to 60 million in revenue, and they're trading at 3x revenue with very
but
nice
the
multiples.
But The Knot went public in Web 1.0, and they were a penny stock, and that would have been a very good buy.
So they've now come back and retold the story, and Wall Street very much buys the business because they're growing. They're not growing at 300%. They're growing at 30%, and they're doing it profitably, and they're adding a lot of value to consumers.
We've got three VCs on the panel here, and I'm just curious. You know, you must have companies in your portfolio that you're thinking about potentially taking public. What's your guidance or thought these days on where does a company need to be in profitability and revenues in order to approach the public market?
That's a good question. I think we should explain, though, for, again, people that are not too schooled in the intricacies of venture capital, that if you're a venture capitalist, you take a stake in a company. You're only going to make money, really, if that company goes public, you know, on a public stock market, then you get a lot of money back, or it's sold to another company. So that's why IPOs are very important, and that's why, I guess, in the venture industry, people are worried a little bit about the IPO market because for small companies it has not been very robust lately.
So. Yeah, we do a lot of work with companies that are in that phase of having built terrific businesses, and they've now set up the goal that they want to be a public company, and that's when they decide to take in some capital because they realize there's value in a partner who can help them go down that path. And I think we've backed there have only been about 150 technology IPOs over the last 4 years, and about 11 of them were backed by Summit. And so we see some characteristics in the public market that you need to have if you want to think about going public. First, generally, you need to have $10 million in trailing quarterly revenue at the time that you're going public. You need to be profitable. It's better if you're profitable, although if you're growing at an incredible rate with high gross margins, you don't have to be profitable. You need to have a good audit history. You need to have good governance. you need to have a big market opportunity, and you need to generally be showing very strong successive quarterly growth. Those tend to be the characteristics. But one caution I would give you is I looked at some data about 12 months ago on NASDAQ, and just under 50% of the companies on NASDAQ had a market cap of less than $200 million, and 18% had a market cap of $50 million or less. And that is a terrible place to be. So public, going public isn't an option to kind of squeeze just over the $200 million market capitalization threshold. You shouldn't consider public offerings unless you could really sustainably see the visibility into your future growth for some years to come. Because the worst fate is to be a public company with all the costs of being a public company without any of the benefits of having that highly valued currency and the reputational effect of being a public company. And it's just a bad outcome for an entrepreneur.
And I would add to that, you probably need visibility until your next three or four quarters. Because those smaller scale companies that go public, once they miss a quarter, the analysts stop paying attention. And then you're in this no man's land where you have no trading in the stock and it really has no benefit to being public.
But to your one more addition to your point. So IPOs and acquisitions are ways to get liquidity. There are other ways to get liquidity for entrepreneurs. You've got a dividend stream. You can raise debt. You can raise a recapitalization or liquidity round from a firm, and there are some firms up here that do that sort of thing, who will provide liquidity to the entrepreneur, allow you to keep control of your business for a second and bigger event. There are other ways to get liquidity from your business besides going public or selling yourself.
Right, but if you take money from a VC, you're boxed in a little bit,
right? Even VCs, if you find the right one, know how to get liquidity from a third path, which is the actual profitability of the company. So it's harder, but they do know how to do it.
Okay. You mentioned
There's an old saying, though, when you take money from a VC, you give your company over to the VC. And when you take it public, they give it back to you.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly.
So don't kid yourself.
And should we, Greg, you mentioned the cost of being a public company. We hear a lot about that today, you know, in the wake of the big corporate scandals over the last couple of years, Enron, et cetera. You know, there's a lot more costs and auditing costs and other, you know, procedures that you have to complete that can be quite onerous if you want to be publicly traded. I mean, if you decide to take VC money in a way, are you sort of already moving down that path? And I mean, could that be a disincentive for some companies?
You know, again, I think you need to look at the program, and this is an honest conversation you have to have with your VC, what the program that they're going to adopt as far as information requirements, board meetings, you know, what is that connectivity to them going to be? Are they going to be calling you up, you know, 4 days before the end of every quarter saying, are we going to make the quarter? Are we going to make the quarter? You know, because that's just not what you want to have. So I think that's a good, frank discussion you've got to have as to you probably should raise VC capital if you feel like it's going to be such an onerous burden that you can't run your business. And so you just have to have that open dialogue as to, okay, what's our working relationship going to be like? And open a bottle of wine and have a dinner and make sure that you really believe the person when they describe it. And call their references, too, and make sure that what they say they do, they actually do in reality.
I do think that it does come back to building a successful company. You must build a successful company, but then you can personally, I like the idea of having the company be acquired because I think there are many complexities, especially within the last few years, about going public. Just a brief story about Grouper, another company that I'm involved with. I was founder and president of Grouper. We raised our Series A, which was Angel. We did B with a few small VCs in San Francisco, and we were actually going out to raise our Series C round of financing, and we were looking at, you know, the $10 million round. And if you're going to go out and raise the $10 million, you've got to hit big numbers, basically, for investors and the employees and everybody to kind of see that that exit. And so we had the VC route that we were going down with Series C, and we actually decided to engage an investment bank named Montgomery & Company. And so we engaged Monty to actually look at packaging Grouper for sale. And so we actually had a term sheet that we had signed with a VC from Sand Hill Road. And during that time, Monty packaged us correctly for Sony to acquire us. So Sony acquired us about a month ago for $65 million. We had actually no revenue. We didn't have a sales team. We had a great product, lots of growth, but we were kind of looking at Series C, raising a large amount of money, or being acquired by Sony. Very happy I took this route over here. And so when you're looking at the different opportunities, I think the acquisition is the way that I like to steer the company.
Well, just can I make one comment? And believe me, if that sounds like a great outcome for Grouper. But I would also argue that if the tenor of this conversation tends to be, if you take money from a VC, they're standing there with a club or a mallet behind you, waiting for you to screw up so they can hammer you on the head. And I know that's never happened to you, Michael. So
once a month, everybody takes a beating sometime, Tony Soprano says.
But that was your wife. That was not me. The average liquidity life cycle on a project for us is 6 to 7 years. A top-tier venture capitalist that is, standard run-of-the-mill is patient by nature. Building a startup takes time. We know you're going to encounter turbulence. Splunk has gone through every standard problem in the book. This is a very good company. We come to the board meetings, no problems occur. So our job is to help drive risk out of a company. Our job is to help make the company successful. This is what we do for a living every day, day in and day out. So this notion that it's an adversarial relationship is absolutely bass ackwards. Mm-hmm. Our job is to put money in and help the thing succeed. And so you're getting venture capital, you're getting acceleration, you're getting help, you're getting juice put into the deal. And so what you should be getting is patience. What you should be getting is guidance and foresight. And if you're getting that, you're getting risk-driven out of the project, not this sort of micromanaging nervousness, anxiety being injected into your life.
If you find the right venture capitalist. I mean, we turn down money from some of the biggest names on Sand Hill Road on our Series A because we felt like we didn't have a lot of things figured out in our business model. Were we going to be a software product? Were we going to be a hardware product? A lot of VCs at the time were saying, well, you sell a solution into the data center in the enterprise, you got to put it in a hardware box, it's got to be an appliance. And we were kind of more intrigued with the software angle. So we turned down a number of very good offers to work with Nick's firm because they said, you know what, we've got this incubation space right off of University Avenue in our offices. Why don't you guys come in and hang out for 3 or 4 months? We'll put the money in the company. We'll figure this out together. And we took quite a bit of time to figure out what was the right business model, talked with, over 60 customers during that time. And, in the end, I think it's going to result in, knock on wood, a much bigger company than we would have had we gone down kind of the traditional route that these other VCs just wanted to plug us into because they had success with a company or two that had gone down that route and that model.
I'd be willing to bet you, though, if you really had gone out and talked to the customers and pushed back on them, they would have said you're right. I mean, that was just the first pitch meeting where they had the idea, brain fart of the week, right? And they're saying, here's my idea just because I was in a customer meeting last week and this feels good.
We've got about 3 more minutes, so if people want to start queuing up for questions, we're going to go to questions in a minute, but we've got time for 1 or 2 more comments. Sorry.
One of the interesting things on this patience point, which folks might not realize and be interesting for the VCs on the panel, is we all have a concept in all of our funds of having a reserve, and usually that's fairly institutionalized. And what that means is if we make an investment of $5 million in a company, we always reserve something to follow on that company in case they need more capital. And for early stage guys, it's oftentimes 1-to-1. I'm a later stage guy, so usually I keep about 50%. So if a VC funds your company for $4 million out of their $400 million fund, there's $4 million allocated for you for a second round financing. So we anticipate problems, and we anticipate having to put more money in order to solve those problems. And something people might not be aware of in terms of how we manage our business.
Well, I was going to ask David, you don't have to answer this, but of the $65 million you sold to Sony, how much did the company, the management team, get versus the VCs and the investors? How does that break down?
Well, about that story, both with Brondell and Grouper, we created a prototype. So for Brondell, I created Brondell.com, and I created an e-commerce store before going out there and pitching other folks. And with Grouper... we created a prototype also on the initial idea. For the A, we just had angels and we just had friends come in there. But for the B, we did the whole song and dance up and down Sand Hill Road. And Josh and I stuck firm to the valuation that we wanted. We said we are not going to raise money for under X. And we had numerous interested VCs. You'll also find VCs have a tendency not to say no. They kind of say, yes, we'll get back to you, maybe, et cetera. But they don't like saying no because, you know, they want to still have maybe that door that's open. So I also just plant that as a seed. If you have a VC that just continues to dodge you, many times they just don't like to say no.
It's not you, it's me answer.
And so we were able to hold a large portion of the company. When we were making the decision between raising the C, when we were going to raise the C, we were looking at having the employees lose control of the company. Mm-hmm. But you know, then you have a much larger exit path going down that path.
Okay. All right, well, I think our time is up, and we're about ready to take questions. I'm sure we've got a lot. Just as a reminder to our audience, this is the Commonwealth Club's In Forum program, and tonight we're discussing venture capital to VC or not to VC. I'm Rebecca Buckman of the Wall Street Journal, and I'm here with Greg Goldfarb, Vice President of Summit Partners, Dave Samuel, Chairman of Brondell Incorporated, Nick Sturiali, General Partner of Seven Rosen Funds, Michael Baum, Chief Executive of Splunk, and Scott Potter, Managing Partner of San Francisco Equity Partners. So let's take the first question.
There seemed to be a split on the panel on the value of offshoring early stage technology and at the seed stage of the company, some being in favor of it, others not. If we take as a standard of a successful exit, say a nine-figure exit, are there any examples of companies that have started with offshore development and then grown to such a successful point that they reached a successful exit at that stage?
I can't name names, but yeah, there are certainly in software I can think of two or three right offhand where their primary development team was overseas. Those specific situations, they didn't do it as a business deal. It wasn't an entrepreneur who said, I'm going to pursue outsourcing as a strategic cost choice. It was an entrepreneur who had a connection to that geography. In many cases, they had lived in that geography and had a unique understanding of how to manage it. Those are the ones that I can think of offhand where there were nine-figure software exits. And so I think that's an important I'm sure there are examples on the other side, but the ones I know for certain are where there was some connectivity there to begin with.
Yeah, I think you have to be careful between the difference of I'm an entrepreneur sitting here in the States and I'm deciding to outsource some of my engineering or product work overseas versus, hey, there's a really hot team of network engineers in Israel that have the next great, you know, management idea for complex networks and bring their company to the States to do sales and marketing and business development work.
Thanks.
Will there come a time or how soon will there come a time where your competition is more internal to corporations and not just Microsoft or Yahoo, but like a venture arm of a GE or Honeywell or 3M or something like that?
Well, all those firms have internal venture capital arms already, and they are.
Yeah, go ahead, sorry. I was just going to comment. A lot of them got very frothy during the bubble, and I think were competitors to traditional early stage. I think most of those guys have pulled back. They make investments with a strategic lens as opposed to a pure financial lens. And I think if you talk to most companies that do that right, they typically have a financial partner like us at the table with them doing the financial legwork, and they're making investments for strategic reasons.
And if you ask most, you know, seasoned entrepreneurs, I'd say people who have started more than, you know, one venture-backed company, at least from my perspective, I tend to look at those with a pretty jaundiced eye. I mean, look at companies like Intel that have made hundreds of venture capital investments, and you don't find a lot of entrepreneurs that say they were a good early stage partner. They might have been a great later stage partner to help you with certain market opportunities, but they're not necessarily the kind of people that are used to investing in early stage companies and are going to be there to help you out when the times are tough.
Just go back to their incentives. I think, again, it's the same point. Go to their incentive structure. Understand what their motivation is. Strategics are motivated by an entirely different goal set than a venture investor. They've got a much bigger ship to manage, and their careers are driven by a much different set of issues than a venture investor is driven by. And so you got to know that going in.
And I also realize most partners in a venture capital firm 5 years from now will still be a partner in that venture capital firm. Most corp dev guys at a big company are not going to be that guy.
And when you guys talk about strategic meeting, if I'm Intel Capital, I'm investing in stuff that's going to – I want it to help my business more than make money. That's,
right. Intel is one of the biggest ones. Like Intel invested in Spinner, my Web 1.0 company, and they invested in – I mean, I don't know the stats, but it's gigantic.
They actually invested in Noah's Ark.
Yeah, so they've invested in many, many companies.
One comment before my question about the outsourcing stuff. My company, we outsourced some smaller projects to some guys in Russia, and we then went ahead and outsourced a much larger project to them, which was a complete disaster. And I think with outsourcing, especially if you're really a U.S. company, outsourcing smaller secondary systems and, you know, not your main core technology is kind of the workable thing there. And part of the reason we did that was because engineering talent over here is so expensive. You know, going back to your point earlier, it's really hard to find very good engineers and be able to afford them if you're just trying to bootstrap. My question was, how do you, you know, I'm a software guy, I'm a banker, I don't really know a lot of VCs. How do you get in the door? How do you find people that are going to be interested in you know, your pitch, your idea, your company?
Go to Breakfast at Bucks.
I actually think these there's a lot of internet conferences. Some of them are very inexpensive. Web 2.0 is expensive to get into, but I know that there are numerous ones that occur in the Valley. Their name has slipped me, but these VCs are going to all of them. And I believe that going to those events is a great way to network and meet where the money is.
There's also a couple of really good associations in the Valley for entrepreneurs. SD Forum, S-Space, they have free events you can go to. You can meet other. I mean, I would say hunt out other people, seek other people that have done it before. I mean, we do that in our business. When we want to go partner with a big company, we don't start top down, you know, or bottom up knocking on doors. We go find friends of ours that have done business with those companies recently, and we say, "How'd you do it? Who'd you talk to at Hewlett Packard?" I mean, you know, tens of thousands of employees. Which person did you approach? You know, how were they? What were their hot buttons? How'd you get a deal done? And I think it's the same in, you know, in the business of starting up a company. You know, hang out at some of these places like S-Face, like SD Forum, come to events like this and meet people and say, you know, how did you do it? Who are the VCs to work with? Who are the guys to avoid, you know?
I think often, too, if you have a lawyer at one of the usual suspect firms, they often refer to the usual suspect venture capital firms. So they refer a lot of deals to us.
What about cold calls? I mean, is the environment such that you guys are taking cold calls or no? No, looks like a negative. Okay.
No, that goes in the circular file pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that goes with the Viagra email and
he does sometimes. One related comment I would say is try to boil it down to a very pithy executive summary. I think the first challenge is to get it in front of somebody, but then get somebody with a 20 or 30 minute attention span to be able to grasp the whole concept. Sending somebody that's a connection, a 50 page word based business plan, I think would have little chance of success.
I mean, I still get 75 to 80 email a day. So, I mean,
I would say other entrepreneurs are pretty open to cold calls though. I mean, I get emails or calls from people on a regular basis saying, you know, I've got this idea. I'm trying to start a company. I don't really know a whole lot about it. How did you go about it? And, you know, I think entrepreneurs, even though they're just as busy as VCs, have a little bit more of a soft spot in their heart for, you know, helping other people learn how to get this done. The great struggle, right? Sharing, you know, the story of who are the people, the folks that came over the Sierras I was thinking of. The Donner Party, right. Sharing the story of the Donner Party with them, right?
Right.
Yeah.
That's a downer.
Thank you for that cannibal story.
Historically, there's always been a gap between university research and the patents they produce and any kind of commercialization stream. And there's starting to be companies popping up now that are either buying up patents and who knows what they're going to do with them, or to the other extreme, like Arrowhead Research, they pick patents and they fund the research to bridge that commercialization gap. What kind of comments do you have on what... Is this a flash in the pan for these IP kind of businesses, or is there really something there, and is it really filling a social need?
I think a lot of universities, at least in kind of the field where I am in computer science, have had to get a lot more practical about the research that they are doing in order to get projects funded. Because remember, most of the people that fund these projects, whether it's at Berkeley or Stanford or somewhere else, are funded by companies. And if they're not practical in the research they're doing, they're not going to get funded by companies. So I agree with you. I've seen a closure in that gap, even at early stages in my current company. We spent time with people at different universities discussing some ideas we were working on, some of the things that they had done. We have some joint research projects ongoing right now with the computer science department over at Berkeley. So I agree with you. I see a closure in that gap. And I would take very seriously as an early stage entrepreneur documenting, you know, your inventions, what you're doing. It doesn't have to be a technical invention necessarily. It could be a business process invention. I found the process of just, I mean, you don't file patents because you think that you're necessarily going to be able to protect your technology. I think you file them because it's a good discipline in writing down how your invention actually works.
I think if you count the number of VCs walking around the Stanford campus, there's probably more there than there are co-eds. So it's a very, very active process. And I think even for the private universities, it's obviously much easier for them than it is for Berkeley, which is, you know, has a different mission. But we're very at Seven Rows, and we are extremely active at Berkeley and Caltech. One of my partners is on the board of Caltech.
But that's a VC perhaps mining specific patents. What about
we don't mine patents. We mine teams.
Okay.
So there has to be a professor, a PhD student. I mean, there has to be somebody who's creating something. The patent is what protects it.
And what I'm asking about is the notion where the company that's being formed is in fact one of these IP commercialization companies. So how would a VC view that kind of a company?
Yeah, I think if it's trying to build a business, I think it's great. If it's buying up patents to use in litigation, it's horrible and should be banned.
were you asking like were you talking about the patent trolls?
No,
but there are people. I mean, it
is a business.
It is a business, yeah. And that's why a lot of the commercialization companies are just building portfolios of patents without any desire to build a business, which, you know, I think exploits the nature of the patent system, and, you know, we could get into a long conversation about that.
Yeah, that's a whole other panel.
But, yeah. if they're isolated, if it's a kind of a search fund sort of approach where somebody finds a piece of intellectual property that they want to build a company around, that's fantastic, and there's no reason it can't be a good business.
First of all, I want to say that I really appreciate the discussion, because I came here with the very question, you know, which was better, VC funding or kind of bootstrapping. And each time someone spoke, I was like, yeah, that's what we ought to do. And then someone else came back and said, no, he's right. So I'm probably going to leave with more questions than I will answers, but that's a good path as well. So for a person who doesn't wake up, as you said, thinking of how to build a better business for the people, because there are business builders and there are idea builders, and usually those people partner to build business. One of my concerns as the idea person is the whole being first to market concern. So I have my idea, I'm incubating it, been working on it quietly for years and years and years, and it's ready to prototype, but then Adobe comes along and builds it. And they build it big, and they have marketing dollars to, you know, make Catherine Zeta-Jones the spokesperson for it. But then also, as Greg would say, the bootstrapping model works well because you have the time to kind of work on the product and not really have all the marketing people in your face asking you the question, how are you going to sell this? And sometimes that question is... it's just you're not ready for that question yet because you haven't really built the product fully out yet. And I think when I look at a successful company like Google, I think, I'm not too experienced, but I think they focused on building something that was outstanding. And then, you know, just, you know, out of the need for this great thing, they found all these different paths to sell it to the public. So... my question would be: is how valid is that concern of being the first to market, you know, in making this decision? And how much do creator idea people need the other half in order to start pitching VCs? Because I feel that if a creator person came to a VC, they would kind of rip him or her apart, saying, well, you have no business model. All you have is this idea. But then I hear that's kind of what the VCs want, is the idea. So
I do think that the team is important. So I think probably if VCs see a group of people walking in, I think they're probably going to be probably more excited about it, having a team to walk in. So I think that that's extremely important. And the whole first-to-market thing, the internet is – the barrier has been basically the barrier is gone around the internet. So there's just so much activity occurring. The idea of being first-to-market for anything is almost – pretty challenging these days because it's relatively simple to set up shop. So the notion that maybe Adobe has put a lot of money after your idea, I don't think that that's too concerning because you know what? Microsoft's going to need the solution and Google's going to need the solution and Yahoo's going to need the solution. If somebody at Adobe saw your same vision, I think that that's fine because it actually validates your space. I think one of the big important things that VCs will ask when they look at your presentation or they look at your business plan is who are your competitors? Because it's difficult to find, if you have an idea that has absolutely no competitors, it is likely that it is not fundable because I'm not a VC, but I'm doing angel investing, and I would be very concerned if somebody says, I don't have any competitors. I mean, somebody must be competing within your space. So the notion that you could put Adobe in there and say that they launched this product, I think it just validates your idea.
I mean, this is the hard part. You go in and you say this, you know, you've been working on your baby for a long time, right? And you're hoping it's beautiful and you're worried that they're going to rip you apart, right? And so you kind of have to go in. And I've been, you know, 13 years, I did 7 rounds of fundraising myself. And I've walked out of there with my tail between my legs more times than I can remember, my PowerPoint all over the floor, thinking I'll never do this again. And you just have to go in there saying, you know, if I get killed, I'm just going to remember all the feedback because this is all good, right? I mean, you have to take all the feedback. Sometimes VCs are rude. You know, I am the first to admit it. We are self-absorbed sometimes, a little too narcissistic. You know, it comes with the territory. You know, we're often very busy, sometimes overworked. You just got to take all the feedback and take it as a learning experience and use it to your benefit. And say, I'm going to take that and evolve my product, my idea, my business to get better and better and better. And so you have to I was in 3 startups. 2 of them failed. 1 of them succeeded. I cannot tell you one thing I remember from the success. I can't. And I can tell you plenty of what I remember from the 2 failures. So often what you'll remember are the bad things and the things or the sharp criticisms. And that's the way your brain kind of works. So the bad things will be the things you'll carry with you. And so you have to look at that as the positive.
So I want to share with you 2 sayings we have in our company that I think have really helped us out. One is go ugly early. We had a product that a lot of the people in the company didn't think was ready for prime time. We put it up on the internet. We let 50,000 people download it and tell us what was wrong with it. The second thing we say in our company is never let your ego get in between you and your wallet. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand. You think that your baby's really beautiful. You don't want to hear people tell you that it's ugly and it can't do this and it can't do that. Well, you need to take that feedback from those 50,000 people. You need to incorporate it into what you're doing. I mean, I can't tell you, you know, the companies that I've been involved in, this one is more interesting than the rest of them because we went out to market earlier with our invention and got so much feedback on it. And it's not until you ask people to part with their dollars and their budget that you're really going to learn what the issues with your product, you know, are at that point in time.
And one thing just to counterbalance that is VCs are wrong more than they're right. So if you walk into a presentation and you don't think they're getting it, you better know your space better than they do.
Yep.
So don't let them take your passion away.
And
chances are those folks don't know your business nearly as well as you do.
Yep.
So go knock another door.
And first mover advantage is very overrated. I mean, look, Google was by far and away not the first mover in search. You know, Microsoft wasn't the first company to create an operating system. We invested in a company called Options Express, which is an e-brokerage firm. We invested in 2005. Had an E-Trade, Ameritrade, Daytech, and all those companies had their heyday in 1999, 6 years later. And that's a terrific business now, a public company. It's 6 years. They were religious about the customer. The question I'd ask anybody here is, how many times have you ever switched off the products of a customer, of a company whose products you loved and whose service you thought was terrific? You'd never, never do it. You'd never do it, and you've never done it. And so the question I'd ask is, are you a feature of someone else's product, or is it truly a distinct product category? Because when you have to worry about first mover, it's when you're a feature of someone's larger product suite. But when you're truly your own product category, your own ecosystem, if you will, you're probably going to be fine taking your time to build your business.
I know it's hard to generalize, but could you talk a little bit about, as an entrepreneur, what I might be looking to give up if I go, like VC versus waiting until I've got a profitable company and then raising some money?
If you go VC, you'll give up your second and third child.
This is a dementor right here.
It's probably hard to encapsulate. I think it has gotten easier for entrepreneurs to hold on to more of their company today because there is so much pent-up demand with the VCs of putting money to work. And I think that when you were raising money, Grouper, we raised our Series A in March of 2004. So, 2006. So it was just kind of the frost was starting to go away at that point in time. And it was okay raising at that time.
But I just have to tell you, these are false choices. I mean, this is not like if I could, should I buy a Chevrolet here or should I wait and get a Prius 5 years later at a different price? Taking venture capital money is everything to do with the relationship of the VC. You can get a VC where the relationship works. You get they bring an amazing amount of juice and networking, and the working relationship is symbiotic, and they bring people, and that connection brings other people, which brings an agile company, which evolves through five different business models, which stumbles into the real business, which is what takes off. Or you can get a VC relationship which doesn't go well, where you go through a dysfunctional relationship where the business peters out and you end up shutting the company down. So I think it's impossible to make those two choices where taking it and not taking it are an option at all. So I think it is totally dependent on the person. It is, in many respects, like Michael said, getting married. And so it's sort of like, should I get married now to this person or should I not get married? Which is better?
I think we may have time for one more question. Anybody have another? Okay. A short one?
I'll keep it relatively short. From a bootstrapping perspective, I find it kind of entertaining. A number of you have successful exits under your belt, and so if I were in a similar situation, I think I would bootstrap a bunch of companies. So how would you temper your views on bootstrapping for someone who may not have that type of experience? And then after that, if you could tell us the typical investment size that you have and your minimum investment size that you typically have.
I'll start. I think it comes back to the type of business. If it's a business that lends itself to efficient prototyping and you can borrow from family and friends and relatives and banks and credit cards and get there and get some of the risk reduction factors knocked down, you should do it. And if you can't, you can't. So, I mean, I think you're right. For 95% of the entrepreneurs, it is a financial decision. And not taking venture might not be an option. In terms of my fund, we look to invest $5 to $10 million in businesses that are north of $10 million in revenue.
I just look at it from a practical standpoint. If you're going to go out and raise money from a venture capitalist, if you're going to raise what's typically thought of as Series A money, You're going to give up as much of the company today as you are 6 months from now. You have to really get yourself, you know, out of the atmosphere from a revenue, you know, customer standpoint in order to dramatically increase your valuation in raising money. So I don't see why you wouldn't go out and raise money as soon as you feel you have the confidence that you know what it's going to take to build the business and you have the confidence that you want to put your life's work into this for the next several years.
Are we talking about minimum fund size or any?
How much in a deal? I'm sorry, what was it?
Yeah, what your typical investment size is and what your minimum. I know you had mentioned 500 grand.
We've done 250,000 up to 10 million.
Okay.
Anything in between.
And we invest from $5 million all the way up to $500 million, both minority and majority positions, typically in companies that don't need our capital. So a lot of the capital goes to liquidity for the entrepreneurs themselves and for the shareholders of the company.
Okay, well, let's give a big hand to the panelists. Thanks for your thoughts. And now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.